Okay. 10-2-2-5-9, United States versus Dale Russell. And Ms. Cook.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, good morning.
My name is Jesse Cook, and I represent Dale Russell, who brings this direct appeal from judgments of conviction and sentences imposed following a jury trial during which he was convicted of four counts of production of child pornography, based on a series of photographs which he took of his daughters, identified in the record as Jane Doe's 1 and 2. Mr. Russell's defense at the trial was that although he took the photographs, they did not constitute child pornography because they did not depict sexually explicit conduct as required by the statute. More specifically, they didn't depict a lascivious display of the genitalia. I want to address the district court's error in admitting evidence of child molesting in Mr. Russell's trial.
You know, I have been thinking about that quite a bit, and I do have a question sort of ready for you, if you don't mind. And I think it would help me. You know, because we've said in a number of cases, including Burt and Siebold, that prior acts of molestation are relevant and admissible to establish a defendant's sexual interest in minors, and therefore to show that his creation of his creation or his distribution of photographs of minors wasn't innocent. So, although of course molestation is not the same as producing child pornography, why wouldn't it be relevant to establish his motive, his purpose, you know, why he took those photographs?
Well, I think that although the purpose of the rule is to allow that kind of propensity evidence, which would otherwise be inadmissible under 404B, because Congress did find that that type of evidence was especially probative in cases of child molesting, this court has developed not rigid guidelines, but at some parameters for the admission of that type of evidence. Not all prior acts of child molesting are admissible, even in child molesting cases under Rule 414. They have to both be probative or relevant, and they have to survive a 403 balancing test.
Didn't the district judge initially exclude that evidence and then decide after the defendant's testimony mm-hmm. that it would be admitted? My question and concern is what happened during the defendant's testimony that caused the district judge to change her mind?
Well, let me first answer your question by saying, yes, she did initially rule that it was not admissible because it was not sufficiently probative. And she found that it wasn't sufficiently probative because there wasn't the temporal proximity of the two events, and because there had been a long period of time after the alleged molestation took place before it was reported, and the judge was troubled by that period of time.
But didn't she also say that the relevance might change depending on mm-hmm. what the defendant argued, mm-hmm. and once the defendant asserted his innocent motive, at that point, the relevance outweighed the prejudice?
She did say that, but the defendant never...
And she also limited... I mean, the child was not allowed to go into lurid detail about this, right? Wasn't it just a yes
or correct.
No, yes or no question?
Yes.
And she answered yes, and that's all she said, and then the defendant was able to impeach by saying you didn't mention this for a long time and all the rest of those things.
That's correct. But I think the fallacy in the court's reasoning was that the defendant never took a position in his testimony as to what the motive was.
Well, sure, he testified about his family's practice of nudism, his history of photography and photographing his daughters. He testified about his creation of that online modeling web. I think there was, you know, there were more than one online modeling websites, and all of that testimony that he gave was absolutely, it would seem, aimed at establishing that, you know, his creation of the photographs in questions were innocent photographs. and were not created to appeal to the prurient interests of the viewers. So under all those circumstances, truly, don't you think that Judge Barker carefully exercised her duty under Rule 403?
No, with all due respect, I don't think that the defendant opened the door to that. The defendant is entitled to present some historical information about his background to put his character into context and to put the evidence that the jury sees into some kind of context so they can accurately evaluate the government's evidence. In this particular case, this defendant took tens of thousands of photographs. The jurors might find it unusual that he had four groups of photographs of these girls in various stages of undress. They might find it less unusual.
Postures. But why isn't more evidence for the jury that, you know, again, on this yes or no basis, on one, in some instance, he sexually molested a daughter?
Well,
I mean, why can't the jury take the jury didn't have to believe that, number one, could have thought it was a recent fabrication. The jury could have thought, well, it doesn't overwhelm his interest in the human body as a subject of photography.
And her, you know, the child's belated disclosure of those incidents. I mean, all of that, wouldn't it go to the weight of the evidence rather than to the admissibility of the evidence?
Well, it goes to the probative value of the evidence, for one thing, and the district court found that those allegations were too prejudicial to admit initially. The admission came only after the defense put on evidence as to the defendant's background. The government itself said that type of evidence would be absolutely devastating to Mr. Russell's case. The court found it too prejudicial. Our position is that this defendant is entitled to say to the jurors, you know, I've studied photography my whole life. I have been employed in the area of photography. I'm a freelance photographer. I take thousands of photographs a year. You know, it puts his photography in context.
Some of the photographs, maybe he takes lots of photographs that are perfectly fine, but if some of them are sexually explicit photographs of minors, whether his daughters or somebody else, the law says you can't do that.
You're absolutely correct, and that's our position on this appeal, that the simple fact that he says, I'm a freelance photographer and I take tens of thousands of photographs, is not the same as saying what his motive is in taking these photographs. It simply puts his photography into some perspective for the jurors.
But I would say to the contrary. I mean, all those other photographs aren't the focus of this prosecution. It's the sexually explicit ones that are. And as the jury tries to decide, is this something that's over the line, the fact that he has, in fact, molested, would cause it perhaps to doubt that there was an innocent purpose.
Particularly if they don't know about his history of photography, particularly if the jury is just given four groups of photographs, all of them depicting these children in various stages of undress, and they don't know that he's taken 10,000 other photographs of them, or they don't know that this is a family that practices nudism, and that's their philosophy.
There was a whole argument before the trial about whether there'd be whether he'd be allowed to call a nudism expert, right?
Yes.
I guess I'm still stuck on the problem of what changed. What happened during his testimony in terms of the development of a defense that wasn't clear ahead of time? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Why there was that change? But anyway, that may be a question I need to ask your opponent and not you. But let me ask you this. Let me go to this issue of, because I think it's very related, of whether it is a legal or a factual issue, how lascivious these photos were. That goes directly to your issue about acceptance of responsibility, correct?
Yes, it does.
How do you propose that we make a distinction between whether this is a legal or a factual defense? Does it depend on the photographs?
I think it does depend on the photographs, and it depends on the context in which the photographs were taken. And according to the statute, it depends on the intent and the taking of the photographs. And in this particular case, the position was that, you know, my client didn't advance any motive. He couldn't advance any motive without running the risk of opening the door, which is what the district court outlined prior to the beginning of the trial. We thought we treaded pretty carefully through that minefield so that he never said, it wasn't my intent to take a photograph displaying, you know, female genitalia in this position for these reasons.
But that leaves him subject to whatever inferences the jury might draw from the particular photographs themselves.
It does, but it doesn't open the door to the admission of the prior bad acts evidence. And I think that the court, in performing the 403 balancing, not only has to look to those issues, but also has to look to the probative value of that earlier bad act evidence, which the court initially found was weak, based on its temporal lack of temporal proximity and the fact that the child had actually denied over a period of 5 years that anything like that had happened in situations where she would have been most likely to have reported it. And those facts didn't change during the trial.
So I take it your emphasis on 403 is essentially you agree that this evidence is admissible under 414. It's just once we reach the 403 level that you're placing your argument and should have stayed out.
No, that's not correct. I think it's also not admissible under 414 because I think that in order for it to be admissible under 414, it has to be relevant, it has to be probative. And, you know, while this court hasn't adopted the LeMay factors and has been, you know, a lot more fluid in terms of what it does look to in making those decisions, there are still some guidelines. The similarity of the conduct, which is absent here. The temporal proximity, the frequency of the conduct, which is absent here. So I think it's not admissible either under 414, and it certainly doesn't survive the 403 balancing test.
Who were his witnesses other than himself?
Who
did
witnesses.
He call for his defense? Just himself.
That's correct. The court disallowed the expert that was tendered. And she did not find that he didn't qualify as an expert under 702. She found that his testimony would not be relevant. And I think that she misunderstood the purpose of the testimony, which was simply to talk about what nudism is and what the philosophy and practice is, and not to look at these photographs, for example, and opine as to whether they were pornography or not.
Of course, he was able to raise his practice of nudism and try and place, you know,
yes,
the photographs in a more, shall we say, in a context that, you know, would be more favorable.
Well, it provides the jury with a little more perspective if they see groups of photographs of children in various stages of undress taken by their father to know that the family is nudist.
Yeah, but additional testimony and exhibits, I mean, they might have further educated the jury about nudism, but it wouldn't have helped, it seems to me, a jury decide whether he took those photographs as innocent family photos or as a commercial product, you know, that he intended to market. So, anyway, I don't want to take any more of your rebuttal time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Hellert.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the Court, my name is Gail Hellert, and I've represented the government throughout this proceeding in this investigation. Starting with the 414 evidence and the question about what did Russell do.
Was he misled by the court's original 414 order into thinking that there was some way in which he could testify about his state of mind in creating these photographs without opening the door to Jane Doe's testimony about the inappropriate touching? I mean, whether or not the touching would have been admissible in the first instance, I sort of have a very hard time imagining any sort of exculpatory testimony that he could have given that would not have opened the door to the molestation evidence.
The court's ruling, no, we don't think he was misled. And the court's ruling at the beginning of the trial, before any testimony started, was also in the context of whether he could admit his nudism expert. So Judge Barker ruled that He can talk about his own nudism and his own nudism as a lifestyle, but he could not put on the attorney John Bauer to talk about his nudism and his lifestyle and how nudists act generally, the wholesome family values and all of that that Mr. Bauer was going to testify about. But the court did say it's not relevant initially, but Mr. Russell can testify that he's a nudist if he wishes, but the door may be opened to evidence coming on that's relevant. And so the impression, it's important to think,
was
too,
was there any clue about what kind of evidence that could possibly be? I mean, obviously the judge knew that once she excluded the nudism expert, it was pretty clear to everybody that he was going to get on the witness stand and he was going to talk about his nudist lifestyle, which had some kind of marginal relevance, it seems to me. I mean, he would have been better off not testifying, but in any event, marginal relevance to the issues. So what happened during his testimony that made a difference?
Yeah, I don't know that Judge Barker would have ever said, here's what won't cross the line and here's what will. But the things that Mr. Russell's case presented, both of cross-examination of the two Jane Doe girls and also in his, and one thing that was a very important feature to us in thinking about how to present this case is really nudism does not equal an avid artsy photographer. There's lots of nudists who aren't photographers as well. But Mr. Russell was claiming to be both of those things. And so we can make a very rhetorical argument about whether he should have testified about his nudism lifestyle. Did that help him or didn't it? He chose to. But the things that he did talk about, certainly on the cross-exam of Jane Doe 1, these are simply the same kind of poses as teen magazines do. These are legitimate modeling. It wasn't unusual to be at the gym with him. The testimony of Jane Doe 2, the defendant took pictures because he told us we were models. And on cross-examination, we went to nudist camps. This was all very normal. The girls chose the pictures was the image that Mr. Russell wanted to portray. The gymnastics pictures were just normal playing around in the gym. So, and on redirect, the defendant had said he wanted to get them a JCPenney or Sears catalog contract, all very trying to make this impression that this was very normal. So during Mr. Russell's actual testimony, avid professional photographer, he has taken nude pictures of his own children and other children. The court immediately, because he wants to put in evidence of books and pictures, his own pictures that he's taken, the court immediately acts like the gatekeeper, as she should, saying, what's the relevance? And the defense says it's his background. And she says there's a lack of foundation for the relevance because all these other pictures you've taken are just not relevant. And so he puts forth again, we go back to testimony, because there's four bench conferences during his testimony.
Could I interrupt you right here? Because I have suddenly realized, I should have spotted this before, that there is a significant reason why we are having so much trouble with this, which is that we do not have, as Rule 30A of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure require, the transcript excerpts, mm-hmm. both from the beginning when the district court initially made her ruling, and then from later on in the trial when the district court reverses herself. Rule 30A1 requires in the appendix the judgment, order, or decision in question and other parts of the record. So that's transcript very often when it's an evidentiary mm-hmm. ruling at stake. And it really impedes our ability to trace through and see what did the, I mean, very legitimate questions. What did the district court say? Why was she persuaded that she wanted in this very tailored way to let this prior incident in? So I think it's, and it was the government's responsibility to put that in. If it was, first of all, the appellant's responsibility, but the government should have also looked at this, because it's very different. I mean, we can root through, and I suppose there are places in the appendix, in the original record.
No. There is no original record over there.
Well, then that's,
where is the original record?
More troublesome.
It is not over there.
We don't have the photographs either.
We have nothing.
Yeah, so even trying to figure out how to evaluate them as a legal or a factual issue, can't do it.
Okay, well, I don't know how to address all of that. I know that I believe that the record of appeal came up.
I think the party should supplement the record personally.
No question.
At least the excerpts of the transcript that show the district court judge's rulings, both her initial rulings. I mean, you said, well, it's kind of blended in with the expert, but I started looking back thinking I didn't remember that, and then I realized, well, the reason I don't remember it is because it's not
it wasn't
here.
There.
And so is this court saying it didn't receive any of the four or any of the three volumes of the trial transcript?
They're not over there, which they normally would be, and so our marshal has just gone out to
because
see.
I won't speak for Ms. Cook. I guess we would both assume those three volumes would come up.
Okay, they're just not here, so they didn't get onto the cart.
Okay, and the exhibits. I know there was a request made to get the exhibits up here. So, as I understood, apparently, I don't know if in every case, but in these cases, it's not necessary until the court requests them, and so then that request was made.
And then there was a snowstorm, and here we are.
But I'm just saying that Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 30 requires the district court's ruling about which somebody is complaining to be part of the appendix. And if it's an evidentiary ruling, it might be in the form of a transcript.
Okay.
So even if they're in the original boxes, which I'm sure they are, we don't know exactly which parts of the district court's ruling you're relying on.
The record was electronically filed.
So we have it. We don't know exactly which pages anybody wants.
So how much time do the two of you need to tell us what pages that we're not rooting?
I can tell you some of the pages, but if you want them in a supplemental filing.
We want them in a filing. 2 weeks? Can you do it within two weeks?
Yes.
And how about you, Ms. Cook? Can you?
Yes.
Okay, 2 weeks. So we'll send an order out. Thank you, Brian.
So at least that'll get all of us starting at the same place.
All right. Do you want me to continue, or are we?
Sure. You might as well.
Okay. And what I was, and I can point the court to some page numbers of Mr. Russell's testimony. I can first say that the initial ruling of Judge Barker came on page 26, because that was the beginning of the trial before any testimony, where she said, it's not relevant initially, but the door may be opened. And that was in terms of those books and the nudism expert. Mr. Russell started testifying about
that was
his...
not with reference to the prior act of molestation.
Those issues were actually probably right before page 26. So it really is right at the beginning of the trial, because she takes those up in limine before the jury gets there. And so she rules initially no 414 evidence. She rules no books, and she rules no defense expert. And she says, but the door may be opened.
And she doesn't alert, I mean, I guess that's where Judge Rovner was picking up. Does she alert Mr. Russell's to what might or might not open the door?
In terms of giving him guidance as to what he could testify about and not open the door or not, no. There's no guidance that she gives him. She just allows him, in her ruling, to say no defense expert on the subject of nudism. That's not relevant. No books on nude people. But, Mr. Russell, if you want to testify that you engage in this lifestyle, okay, I'll let you do that. That's part of your story.
And you never objected on the grounds that if he testified to certain things, the door would be open.
We did. We generally said nudism is not relevant.
Right,
but we know we can't stop the defendant from testifying as to his life story. I mean, that's just something we expect.
Why would you have objected anyway if you wanted to get in this explosive evidence?
It's just not relevant. The fact that Mr. Russell is a nudist, if the government tried to put that on as to show that he was more likely a molester or more likely that these were lascivious exhibitions, that would be not allowed. And so we don't think the defense should be able to put on the fact that he's a nudist, and so it's less likely that these pictures were lascivious. The membership in that class just doesn't matter. It's just not relevant.
Nothing happened during, once Judge Barker made her initial ruling on page 26 or before, nothing happened before she changed her mind to warn the defendant that he was getting close to opening the door. I guess
no,
that's the bottom line.
Okay, I wouldn't agree with that, because Mr. Russell portrays this whole impression that everything that he did was innocent, that was part of his nudism lifestyle. And so that's where I was in the middle, and I can cite pages to this, and actually court rulings is more important, because on pages 250...
But you're going to do that in your...
I will do that in the record, yes.
So why don't you
I can
just
do that in,
argue whatever you...
Okay. Mr. Russell argued that he had won awards for his photography. He wanted to offer his typical pictures. He considered his work fine art photography. He put forth, therefore, this subjective intent artistic defense, something like that, like, I'm a nudist, so if I can judge my pictures to be innocent, then they are innocent. That's not the test. The test is not what Mr. Russell thinks. The test is how this statute is written. Whether Mr. Russell used, or any of those other verbs, a minor to engage in sexually explicit conduct with the intent that they engage in sexually explicit conduct for the purpose of producing the visual depiction. And several more sites in the record from him, he had books from photographers who have photographed.
So you said you were objecting along the way, or you were saying something?
Yes, we were. What we were objecting to was his actual admission of these books. We find these books in his collection, the Jock Sturgis, some other ones were referred to, of people taking photographs of nude families, including children. He had those books, and he wanted to introduce them as this, we felt, as this is the line. That's not the line. Those people don't get to decide what is the law under 2251 and what isn't. So we were very much objecting to those books coming in and to other photographs that he's taken coming in, because we don't want the judgment at an art show to be the standard for, well, that must be legal. The defense put forth the case Hamling, which is the case that said in obscenity cases, comparators aren't relevant either. That was the same kind of idea. Just because these pictures are sold at Barnes & Noble doesn't mean anything, and they could be illegal, and other people are violating the law. And so that wasn't the mark. So the again, more about Dale Russell, but then I want to bring it up to how that became relevant. I'm a nudist. I've been a nudist since age 4. We've all visited nudist camps and taken nudist vacations. I did these modeling websites for my children to help them through college. These were Jane Doe's ideas. The two Jane Doe's ideas were for the modeling websites. That called their credibility into question. The girls chose their website names. That called the girls' credibility into question, because they said Dad chose their website names. He denied paying them for nude photo shoots. That calls the girls' credibility into question. He says he never posted nude Jane Doe pictures. One of the Jane Does said that her nude pictures were on there. He admitted photographing the Jane Does in the nude. He said there was nothing inappropriate about the gym pictures or the count three bathroom picture, the one of Jane Doe 2 coming out of the shower. And he said he's taken 50,000 to 70,000 pictures per year. They just went into a shoebox. Well, that needed to be balanced, and the court, so it was that huge impression, and also just the cross-examination of the girls that gave the court pause to say, you're promoting that you're just a nudist. In fact, there's another side to you, Mr. Russell. And all through that, which will be in the supplemental, the four times that the court doesn't allow the nudism books and all those materials. So your argument defense is it's just nudity. So the government gets to present the other side. And the other side is there were these touching incidences, although we still say that what was put on at sentencing in the details could have been put on in our case in chief. We certainly don't want 414 to be read so narrowly. We think the judge gave an extremely beneficial ruling to Mr. Russell in narrowing it so much, because the details could have been put on in the 414, pursuant to Rule 414 in our case in chief. But the Jane Does 1 and 2, to judge lasciviousness, which is the other part of your question, because that's a very important part, The defendant is just saying just nudity. That's all this is. I'm a nudist. These are just nude pictures. But that's not true. The Jane Does 1 and 2 talk about how Dad chose the clothing, how he bought the clothing, the provocative clothing. He staged the settings. He staged the locations, and he took many pictures within a series.
Ellard, I've given you about 3 extra minutes.
Okay.
And I'm going to have to give Ms. Cook the 3, whatever extra minutes I gave. I'm going to have to stop.
That's fine, Your Honor. And we see our red lights on. I want to be respectful of that. So, all right, we'll do the supplemental. And then the court does have the record, though.
Electronically filed. So thank you very much. Thank you. I don't like to break in, but... Okay. Yes, I do. I like to break in.
I do have a notice from the district court dated February the 3rd that indicates that a supplemental record, including the photographs, the exhibits, was transmitted to this court. So the photographs should be here. Nowhere during the trial did Mr. Russell testify that he judged his photographs to be innocent. He never judged his photographs during the trial. That was left for the jury. What he did do was to explain what his lifestyle was. He never said, because I'm a nudist, if I take a nude photograph of a child, that's just done because I'm a nudist and I'm a photographer. That was not the point. The point was so that the jurors wouldn't think father is taking a nude photograph of daughter, and that is completely outside the parameters of normal behavior within the family. Within this family, it's not outside the parameters of normal behavior. And the judge recognized that nudism is not something that most families encounter. It's not something that people have a great deal of information about. I assume that's why she allowed him to put on that evidence. She never said, if you put on the evidence of nudism, then you're opening the door. And we don't believe that we did open the door. I mean, this court has addressed the whole doctrine of how a door is opened and what the government is allowed to do when a door is open. In the Lurch case, which I cited, you know, the court says that the purpose of allowing a party to introduce evidence on a specific issue under the open the door doctrine is to rebut a false impression that's created by the other party on the same issue. To rebut a false impression. There was no rebutting of any false impression. What Mr. Russell testified about was that he was a freelance photographer. The government never impeached him on that.
What about all the references to the girls that Ms. Hellert was just talking about, that they asked for the website or that they in some way were directing things, testimony inconsistent with what they had said?
Well, it was inconsistent with what they had said. The government's own witness contradicted some of what the girl said. I mean, the girl who said that she saw nude photographs on her website, the government agent had to use a password to access the websites. The government agents never found any nude photographs on the website. And the mother who saw the photographs from the website early on, none of those were nude photographs. So there certainly was some contradiction of what the girl said. But Mr. Russell never testified.
But the point is that perhaps the district judge couldn't have anticipated that particular contradiction and might have wanted this one-word answer to the question about touching. In other words, I guess what Judge Gottschall's been asking is what changed, and so that might be something the judge couldn't have anticipated.
Well, we believe that the evidence that came in was entirely predictable based on the pretrial hearings. I don't think that anything changed that would have allowed the judge to make a different decision specifically with respect to the 403 balancing.
And all right.
I see my time's expired. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I want to thank both Ms. Hellert and Ms. Cook. And Ms. Cook, you were appointed, and you have the deep thanks of the court for the fine job that you have done for your client. Many thanks. And many thanks to you, too. So, case taken under advisement and...